Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. Podcasts of prior shows are also available on both those websites. And you can look for a topic of interest to yourself and listen with pleasure. I do want to tell folks, though, you don't realize sometimes when you're doing a radio show, I was once told that people listen in snippets. So occasionally, regular listeners will notice I sometimes repeat myself. And it is because of that. I'll summarize, I'll recap, I'll repeat. Because sometimes people are only catching parts of the show. I would love to think that someone's listening for the entire hour on their drive. But usually you're running in trying to get your dinner. But you can turn that radio on at home and listen to the whole show as well. But those old podcasts are available in addition. So today is March 15th, 2017. The markets were up today. The Dow closing at 20,950, the NASDAQ at 5,900, and the S&P at 2,385. What the Fed raised interest rates just a tad today. So that was interesting. I don't really pay attention too much to that stuff, but I know the markets and people who are doing financial management love talking about it, but it is what it is. I thought it was long due. So that's just my opinion. Folks, what are we doing tonight? We are in the midst of tax season. So regular listeners know the last couple of weeks I've taken listeners' questions about their tax returns. I love answering questions. If you have them, I am happy to do that. The phone number is 610-758-8810. And you can talk live on air with me. If you do so, we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay. We can talk without confusion. If you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Lori C. in the studio. She'll take your call, write down the question. They'll bring it in to the studio. I'll do my best to answer it. So on air or off air, however you're more comfortable asking questions. We are live tonight, obviously. And we do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic. I'll do my best to answer them. The phone number again is 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can reach me through that website as well. So, listeners' tax questions, happy to do that. I also like to give you an idea of some tax-related information as well, kind of background information, fill in the airtime between listeners' questions. And I thought it might be interesting, or maybe not for all of you, to talk about some of the odd things we see during tax season. One thing that I see people sometimes struggle with are something called the Schedule K-1. K as in kitty cat or kitten, Schedule K-1. So I want to talk about a Schedule K-1. And what's really interesting is someone could actually have three different K-1s, and they could all have different boxes. I'll explain what I mean by that in just a minute. I also will see if I can touch on foreign tax credits. Are you taking them? 529 contributions. Do you know how important those are for Pennsylvania? Do you even know what they are? And use tax. Some people pay attention to something called a use tax, and some people don't pay attention to it, but Pennsylvania pays attention to it now, and it's on page 2 of the PA 40. So I thought I might touch on that for a minute as well. So again, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. So let me start by talking about the Schedule K-1. Why would you get a K-1? What is a K-1? A K-1 is a tax reporting document, just as you receive a W-2 for wages. So it's easy to kind of think W for wages, W-2. And the W-2 is your actual tax reporting information. Some people get confused and say, I'll get my W-4 for you. But your W-4 is what you complete when you get hired at a new job as an employee. And you have to let the employer know what your Social Security number, name, address, and filing status and exemptions that you're going to claim. That's the W-4 form. That reports wages. Then we have 1099 INT for interest, 1099 DIV for dividends, 1099 R for retirement accounts or retirement distributions. So the K-1, I don't know where the K comes from. Can't tell you what it means, except that it could mean several different it could mean that you have reporting information from several different entities. But bottom line, it is a tax reporting document. If you get it in the mail, your envelope on the outside should say important tax information. In fact, anyone who's mailing tax information to you that is being reported to the IRS has to have stamped on the outside of your envelope important tax information enclosed. So this Schedule K-1, some of you may be familiar with the K-1 if you are a partner in a partnership, a shareholder in an S-corp, or perhaps a beneficiary of an estate or a trust. So the K-1 is an income reporting vehicle for what we call pass-through entities. If you're a partner in a partnership, the partnership is its own entity, files its own tax return, but the income passes through to the partners. So we call that a pass-through entity. How does the partner know what income to report? They know by virtue of the Schedule K-1 that is part of the partnership return that when the partners file their tax return, they also are required to give each partner their own K-1 to say what their portion of income and or deductions would be for their partnership interest. An S corporation is a corporation that is treated as a pass-through entity with shareholders. An S corporation has employees. If you're a shareholder, you may be one of those employees getting a W-2 from the S corporation. Unlike the partnership return, partners don't get W-2s, partners get K-1s. Shareholders in S corporations will get a W-2, but they also might get a K-1. So I will talk about what that means in just a minute. And then I will also go in and talk about a K-1 from an estate or trust. And I think that's where quite a few people, if you haven't already started to see them, will start seeing them, because you're as a beneficiary of an estate. We're seeing, you know, baby boomers, we're getting older, we're inheriting from our parents. If you are a beneficiary of their estate, chances are you may receive a K-1. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. And some of you might think, wait, I didn't get a K-1. Or wait, Dad died last year and I'm a beneficiary. Am I supposed to be getting a K-1? So we'll talk about that in just a minute. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And we will be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets, on the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We are in the midst of tax season. For folks who have questions about taxes, I'm happy to take your calls. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air or off air. Just give your question to Lori C. if you don't want to talk on air. In the meantime, I'm talking about some of the more unusual things that people may have on their tax returns. Granted, if someone has a partnership and is a partner and has been for years and years, this isn't unusual for you to have a K-1 from your partnership. It could be very usual, and it's probably no big deal to you. But occasionally, we have people who all of a sudden have a K-1 and didn't know what it was, and sometimes they look really different and they look complicated. A couple more notes to mention on the partnership K-1s. If you have a business, you could have a business that's a partnership. And again, you have someone who prepares the partnership return, they give you a K-1. There are partnerships, though, that the general public could have that may not be a business that they're involved in. What would that be? Well, if you have investments, you may have a financial advisor, or you yourself may have invested in limited partnership or a master limited partnership as an investment. So it's not necessarily a business. It could be an investment. And typically, when we look at the ownership interest on these kinds of interests, we're talking about 0.00003% partner, because you and, you know, a million other people are invested in this as an investment. Those K-1s sometimes throw people off as well. And there's different kinds of income that we can get from partnerships. So this is where it gets confusing. And I'm not going to be able to get into all the details of it because it could be just a bit too complicated. But I want to just alert people to when you may have to pay attention as to whether or not you would have a K-1 and what you should do with it. So in general, business people will know and they'll report it as usual as their pass-through income. It's those ones that are for the investments that you have. And I'm just going to throw out a name like Buckeye. People have heard of Buckeye Pipelines, Buckeye Partners. That is typically something people in the Lehigh Valley have liked for a long time, may have made an investment in them years and years ago. You go to do your taxes. If you have an investment in your regular individual account or joint account, you have to wait for that K-1 to be ready before you can finish your own tax returns. Now, the partnership tax returns were due March 15th, so you should have your K-1 by now. Now, granted, partnerships can also request an extension of time to file, and if they do that and you don't have your K-1 till after April 15th, you may have to extend your tax return as well. But typically, once you get that K-1, you're going to report that income. Typically, that income is considered passive because it's just an investment that you've made. You're not out there, you know, fixing cars and in your business. This is an investment in a passive activity. Sometimes, again, these are publicly traded partnership interests that you can get through your broker. So those K-1s you really need. Because the information that's on your 1099 for those partnerships is not really the only income that you have to report. Typically, what you see on the 1099s for those investment-related partnership interests, those limited partnership interests, usually on your statements or your 1099, they might show you the distributions from those partners, from those partnerships, but it's not the taxable impact of that partnership. So, for example, you can invest in XYZ partnership as an investment, one of these publicly traded partnerships. Maybe you invest $10,000 and they pay you $100 a quarter. And you're thinking, wow, this is awesome. I'm getting $100 a quarter. That was really a great investment. I'm getting $400 back. Well, that isn't income necessarily. You don't even know what it is until you get that K-1 from the partnership. So then March 15th rolls around. You get the K-1 in the mail. It says you've, down at the bottom of the K-1, it shows what you invested, $10,000 in your capital account. It shows $400 distribution. Woohoo, got $400. It shows income, negative $100. Well, folks, what really happened then is if we invested $10,000, they gave us $400. That reduces our initial investment from $10,000 down to $9,600. Now they said that we have a $100 loss that we get to report on our return. Oh, so I get to report a $100 loss on my return. Maybe, maybe not. Again, this might be a little bit too complicated for the show tonight, but I'm just mentioning this, that's something you have to pay attention to. Not all is as it seems. So we have a $100 loss that we have on our return. Now, guess what? That $100 loss further reduces our basis. So now I have technically my investment is not $10,000 in that partnership. It's now $9,500. If the next day I sold that partnership for $9,500, you might think, oh, I had a $500 loss. Well, no, you didn't, because your basis is only $9,500. You got $9,500. So there's activity on that K-1 that could be very important to you for future transactions that you report. Sometimes two people will say, oh gosh, I had a $100 loss. I get to take that on my tax return. Not necessarily, because on these kinds of partnerships that are passive, you have to have passive income to offset these passive losses. You don't necessarily get to take these passive losses currently. So sometimes they're suspended and they carry forward until you either have now passive income to offset them, or you have an entire disposition of that partnership interest. All right. So that $400 you got from that partnership isn't necessarily income. It could be just a return of your own investment. So that's what sometimes people don't realize. So that's partnership K-1s. Important. The other thing that's important to look at when you get those in the mail is you look to see what kind of owner box is checked. There's a box on the K-1 that says entity type. Let me see if I printed one off so I could reference it. When we look at the K-1 for the partnership, it will say what type of entity is the partner, and it'll say maybe individual, or it might say IRA. Well, if it's an IRA, chances are you don't have to pay attention to that at all, that K-1, because the activity that occurs in your IRA, it doesn't matter what's going on, interest, dividends, this K-1. It only matters when you take money out of your IRA. There is something called unrelated business income, it's UBTI, I think, unrelated business income, that occasionally could give you a little hiccup for an IRA, but again, too complicated for the show right now, but I just want to mention that. So those partnership K-1s could impact if you're a business owner or if you have made an investment in a partnership. Then you have to know that it's a passive activity, typically, if it's an investment, and any losses may only be used against other passive income, or they may be suspended until you have other passive income or entire disposition. So that's the partnership K-1s. The S-Corp K-1s, remember I mentioned S-Corp is for shareholders. You may work for the S-Corp. You may be the only employee for the S-Corp. You may be the only shareholder for the S-Corp. You may be one of a number of shareholders. So there will be lots of information, a separate tax return. In the end, you have to watch and see if you have information that you have to report from that S corporation as well. And I'm going to talk about the difference between being an employee at the S corp as well as a shareholder and what you have to watch out for and not get too aggressive with in just a minute. Folks, if you have questions, it's tax time. Phone number 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We are talking about taxes, and in particular tonight, I'm just throwing out, you know, random information about K-1s, Schedule K-1, what the heck's a K-1? Maybe you need to pay attention, maybe you don't. I also want to, if I have time, touch on foreign tax credits and 529 contributions and use tax, so I'll push that more toward later in the show. But in the meantime, if you have questions, you can talk live on air with me or off air. Just give your question to Lori C. and she'll write it down and bring it in. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Let me talk about S-Corp for a minute. An S-Corp is a pass-through entity. So a C-Corp is a corporation, big company. They have employees. And if you are a shareholder in a corporation, they might pay you dividends. They might not. But that's how that works. You're not reporting the company's income or expenses on your own personal tax return. Whereas an S corporation, you've kind of set it up like a corporation for certain liability protections and maybe to pass it on to other family members eventually. But the S corporation is a pass-through entity where you're actually going to report the activity. Some of the activity may pass through to you. But the S corporation, if you're working for the S corporation, you actually have to be paid like an employee and receive a W-2, which is unlike a partner. In a partnership, if you are the partner in the partnership and you work for the partnership, you don't get a W-2. You get a pass-through on your K-1 of all the income. The S corporation, if you are working for it, you have a W-2. So why do people set up S corporations? Well, one of the big attractions for S corporations was you could work at the S corporation and get paid a W-2. And as you know, as an employee, your W-2 income is subject to self-employment tax, which is 7.65% of your pay as an employee, and your employer typically pays the other half, 7.65%. So when I'm self-employed, I have to pay both sides of it, the employee and the employer. When I'm an employee, I only pay my side of it. So what some of the S corporations would do, they'd pay themselves, $20,000, and they would pass out the rest of the income. Let's pretend my S corp made $100,000, and I paid myself $20,000, and I passed out $80,000 of profits, in my very simple example, $80,000 of profits to myself. Well, the profits aren't subject to self-employment tax. It sounds like a roll win, doesn't it? So
why wouldn't we all do that? So I'm just going to take minimal wages and pass the rest out as profit, and then I don't have self-employment tax, which sounds way better deal than the partnership where I'd have to pay it on both sides. So here's why it became a problem, because the IRS realized that people were taking advantage of this, I don't know, what do you want to call it, strategy, technique. And they said, hey, folks, this is not going to continue to work. You can't pay yourself some nominal wage and pass the rest to yourself as profits. So the IRS really hampered down on these several years ago. And they said, hey, we're going to take a fine-tooth comb to these S corporations. And we're going to say, is this really a reasonable pay? So let's pretend you are a professional, a doctor, and you have your own practice, and you're the only doctor in the practice, and you have a nurse, and I'm getting too complicated. Let me say you're a therapist. You're a therapist. You're the only one working for your company. And if you worked outside of at a hospital or a counseling center, they would pay you $100,000. Now you're doing your own therapy out of your home and you make $100,000 and you give yourself a W-2 for $20,000. Do you see that? That's not fair compensation. That's not reasonable. The IRS is going to say, what are you doing? Who's generating the income? What would you make on the outside? What is reasonable? They probably would expect you to W-2 $100,000. I mean, in my example. So you've got to be careful. Then they're not as attractive as they used to be. So S-corps, if you're a shareholder in an S-corporation, and you might not be the one who works there at all. You might have been the person who fronted the money. Maybe it's a business and you just fronted the money and you don't work there. You don't have to get a W-2, but maybe you're sharing in the profits, 25%. So then you might get a K-1 showing that you had business income of $20,000 or profits of $20,000. All right. So you want to pay attention to those K-1s. I had a caller call in, Mary from Allentown. She said her daughter left her job and was mailed a 401k check, which she cashed, only a few hundred dollars. It happened in 2016. Is it too late to roll it over to avoid tax implications? Mary, she would have had to have rolled it over within 60 days. So in essence, what happened? Daughter left the job. Some of these employers now, if it's under a certain amount, in the old days, I think they just would kept it on their books and it became administratively burdensome for them to keep these straggling accounts for people who left on their books. So they modified some of the rules and have as part of their plan now, if accounts are below a certain balance, maybe it's $1,000 or $5,000, the employer is allowed to just write a check and send it to the person. I think in some cases they can roll it over to an IRA or something too, but they can distribute it. So if you take a distribution from a 401k pre-age 59 and a half without other certain exceptions, then it would be a taxable event if it was a regular 401k. So let's pretend it was $300. So now her daughter has to report $300 early distribution. She'll get a 1099-R with a code 1, which says early distribution, no known exceptions. She will pay tax on $300 if indeed she has taxable income. Mary, maybe your daughter wasn't working and maybe she doesn't have any, enough income to be taxed. But she still would have the 10% penalty because the 10% penalty for early distribution comes after the tax calculations. So she would be subject to it. On $300, 10%, $30. She would owe $30 on a $300 distribution. You might look to see if there could be an exception to the penalty. For example, if she left employment and she was age 55 by December 31st of the year she terminated employment, then that is an exception to the 10% penalty for early withdrawal from a 401k. There may be other exceptions. You'd have to look, because IRAs have different exceptions to the early withdrawal penalty than 401ks. I don't know if she bought a new house or something like that. I'd have to look up which one applies to which. I've got too much in my brain to remember everything. Mary, I hope that helped. Sorry for your daughter, but it doesn't sound like if it's too much, it'll be too big of a penalty, too big of a surprise. All right, folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station, your source for NPR news, public affairs, and a great mix of hand-picked music. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 27 degrees under overcast skies. Tonight, blowing snow, lows around 15. Thursday and Friday, mostly sunny with highs in the mid-30s. Friday night and Saturday, chance of more snow mixed with sleet and freezing rain, lows in the 30s. The time now is 6:31. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. I think everyone must be shoveling still or something. Probably. You know, last couple of weeks we've had lots of tax questions. Tonight's been a little quiet. Happy to take questions live or off air, whatever you're more comfortable. Lori can write the question down and bring it in to me, or you can talk live with me. Phone number is 610-758-8810. I'm just talking about K-1s to fill in airtime. K-1s, these could be the tax documents you miss, and they could be important. So I've talked a bit about partnership, S-Corps. Let me move on to talking about estates and trust. So if you are a beneficiary of an estate or trust, and you receive a distribution from the estate or trust, you may get one of these K-1s. Now, what kind of beneficiary am I talking about? You might be someone, you might think, well, I'm the beneficiary of my dad's estate. Well, if dad had all bank accounts where you were joint on those bank accounts or payable on death, non-probate assets, then you may not end up getting a K-1 if all of the assets were non-probate in not in his estate, either through joint titling or beneficiary designation, something like that. You may not end up getting a K-1. There may still be reasons to have a K-1, even when there might not have been those kinds of assets. Maybe you had to open up an estate for managing some other piece of real estate that didn't generate income, but maybe you still had legal fees and executor commissions. There might be a reason to have an estate, do an estate income tax return, so that the beneficiary, the residuary beneficiary, has an opportunity to get a deduction for those excess deductions over the income. So I'll talk about that more in just a minute. I have a caller on line one. We have Emily from Allentown. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Hi, how can I help you?
I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
We moved our elderly father-in-law in to live with us. Can we deduct him as a dependent? And if so, what do we need?
Okay, it depends on probably when you moved him in and how much money he makes. There's different dependencies.
He doesn't work.
He doesn't work, but he sometimes they have pensions that could throw you out. So there's something called a qualifying relative, and the qualifying relative is someone who's not a child, and they have to meet certain tests. They have to be a member of your household or
by relationship, which father and member of your household now, check. You've got both those. There's a gross income test and a support test. So the support test is you have to provide more than half his support. And when we talk about support, it could include housing, food, food and shelter. It could mean transportation. So you'd have to look to see what his support costs and are you providing more than half his support. And then there's the gross income. And the gross income is the one that I think people find the hardest to hurdle to get over. And they must have less than $4,050 for 2016. I'm not sure what it is going to be in 2017. So if he makes more than $4,050, you may not, he'll be over that gross income threshold. But here's the thing to keep in mind. They don't count Social Security when they're looking at gross income. That might factor into the support test for you, but they don't count Social Security. So unless if he only has Social Security, that's it. Then the gross income, check. Relationship, check. So then you would just have to make sure you're supplying more than half his support. All right.
Okay.
So that's what you want to watch for. And then two, if you can claim him as a dependent, then you get the exemption status and he wouldn't get it for himself. But then if there's medical expenses that you're paying for him, you may be able to deduct those if you itemize. The trouble with itemizing is it's so hard to get over that medical threshold unless someone has a lot of medical expenses. So,
okay.
One other thing, Emily. Let's pretend you have a sibling and let's say you all kick in to help. You can all agree that one of you is still going to claim. So even if you personally might not provide more than half the support, if it's your father-in-law, maybe your husband's siblings, if together you all provide more than half his support, together you can all agree that one of you is going to claim him. And typically that would be the person that they're probably living with. All right?
Okay. If he dabbles in the stock market and gets a couple bucks like that, would that be his income? Would that be considered?
Yes.
Income?
Yes,
okay.
That's included. So if he has interest, dividends, capital gains, sales on assets, that all goes into that gross income test. And it's gross income. Right.
Okay.
All right.
And now I have another question.
Uh-huh.
My husband's turning 66 and I'm turning 64.
Okay.
Is there an age where you should stop contributing to a Roth IRA?
Well, in order to contribute to a Roth IRA, you have to have earned income. So you both have to be working, or one of you has to be working. And there's also income thresholds. As long as your income, married filing joints under $184,000, you both can contribute. And when you're over 50, you could each contribute $6,500. I love Roth IRAs. If you are still have earned income and your cash flow allows it, I say, great. Fund those Roth IRAs.
Okay. So there's nothing like an age limit. If you reach 65, you should just stop doing it.
No, as long as you
okay.
Yeah, as long as you have earned income, you can keep doing it. And you can always get out those original contributions. And once you're over 59 and a half, you could take out the earnings as well. So there's no real downside here. You want to make sure you're investing what is hard for me sometimes is when I see people put a Roth IRA in cash. The idea of the Roth IRA is to grow to receive cash, tax-free earnings.
Uh-huh.
So if you're going to have cash in the bank, I'd like to see that in your emergency fund, not your Roth IRA. But, there's no investment advice given here. I'm just kind of giving you some general information.
Uh-huh.
Each person has to decide for themselves. But that's always kind of like a flag for me. Why would someone put their Roth IRA in cash when the goal of it is to have tax-free earnings?
Okay.
All right. Great. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, love those calls, love those questions. Those are some great questions. 610-758-8810. So
when we talk about a Schedule K-1 for an estate or trust, that K-1 could have some really important information. But typically, the person who's getting a K-1 from the estate is someone who's considered the residuary beneficiary. And what I mean by that is the will says, hey, I give $5,000 to this person, I give my doll collection to this person, and the residue to my favorite daughter, Lori. Then I'm a residuary beneficiary. So if the estate now had $100,000 of investments and $1,000 of dividends, there's $1,000 of dividend income. If there are no expenses, if in my example, there are no expenses against that, and now I'm getting the $100,000 of investments, that is a distribution to me, and the income follows that distribution. So in a final, you know, in a final year or the year I'm getting a distribution, I might get a K-1 reflecting $1,000 of dividends. And when I report that on my tax return, that $1,000 of dividends will come through over on that Schedule B dividend schedule. So that's typically a residuary beneficiary who's going to be getting that information from an estate K-1. And in a minute, I'll talk about trust and why that's important. But in the meantime, I have Jane on line one in Allentown. Jane, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, how can I help you?
Okay, I have a parent whose only income is Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a point where they don't have to file taxes anymore?
True.
Or tax return?
Yes, that's true. They don't have to file if that's the only thing they have. And sometimes the IRS will actually send them a letter saying, hey, we've noticed that you have this, but you don't have to file anymore. What happens with Social Security is, if it's the only thing the person is getting, it's not taxable. Social Security is sometimes taxable depending on how much other income they have on their return. So let's pretend your mom only had Social Security, but then she inherited something and she had $50,000 of IRA distribution on her return.
Okay.
Well, now her Social Security is going to be included somewhat.
Right.
So then she'd have to file again. So, but generally from year to year, if that's the only thing she has, she doesn't have to file. Now, let me mention, Jane, if mom lives in Pennsylvania and she rents or she's a homeowner, she might still want to file something called the PA-1000, which is a rent rebate or a tax rebate form. And she would need to have her Social Security information for that filing.
Okay.
But again, she probably would qualify for a nice little rebate if indeed she rents or is a homeowner.
Okay. Now, what about if she lives in a trailer park, so she owns the trailer, but she rents the lot? Would that qualify for that?
I think that might still qualify, right.
Okay.
It might limit what kind of rebate she would get back. But what they have a form that's with the PA-1000, and it's called like the landlord claim form.
Okay.
Someone at the trailer park, if there is a main office, you mm-hmm. can ask them. Sometimes they will complete that for the person,
okay.
at least that piece of it. And then typically in that calculation, they look for half the Social Security. But I assume your mom's over, is she over 65?
Yeah, 77.
Okay. Right. So there's age requirements on those.
Okay.
Younger for widows. But yeah, so if she hasn't filed for that before, that might be something to check out. She might get a little bit of something back. And to me,
okay.
anything is great.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a PA-1000?
Yep,
form?
It's called the PA-1000.
Perfect.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jane. Have a good night.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's what we do here at WDIY. I hope that works out for her. We educate and inform. We have an informed listening audience. I appreciate all these great questions. And the beauty of asking questions, folks, is other people have these questions too. So if we can help one person, I'm hoping that we can help a lot more. So that PA-1000 is something that people might forget about. In fact, I had a client who I think lives in the Nazareth area, and I found out, I believe that Nazareth has some of its own tax credits on top of the PA-1000. So that was something I had not known until last year. And they used to apparently write little articles about it in the newspaper, but
Another colleague of mine had told me that he never sees it in the paper anymore, but knew that it was still available. So I think if you live in the Nazareth area, there may be an additional tax credit that would be available for you. We are coming up on our last break. Folks, if you have questions, I love them. The phone number is 610-758-8810. And we will be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. If you have questions, we still have plenty of time. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Another point about estates that some people might not realize, too, is if there was a home in the estate, let's pretend Dad owned a home. He has now died. It's the only thing he had. And you sell the home. Some people don't realize that could actually be a tax-favored event for the beneficiaries. So you want to make sure, for those do-it-yourselfers, that you talk to someone who might know more, a little bit more about it, all right? You have to be careful with some of the things you do, or you have to be aware so that you don't miss out on deductions that you may end up getting. Estates can have a fiscal year. A fiscal year is something other than a calendar year. So typically when we talk about partnership K-1s, S-Corp K-1s, typically we're talking about a calendar year filing, and it matches up with your individual filing. We're all on calendar years. Estates can have a fiscal year. So I might have someone who passed away in 2016, but we might not have to report the income or deduction ramifications from being a beneficiary of that estate until 2017, because the fiscal year might go from whatever date in 2016 through whatever date in 2017. So a fiscal year is something other than a calendar year, but it's not more than 12 months. So if someone dies on September 1st of 2016, my fiscal year could be January 1st, 2016 to August 31st of 2017. So you want to pay attention if maybe brother or sister are the executor, and maybe you got some kind of a distribution, but you don't know what kind of tax ramifications you might have from that distribution. You want to check with them before you finalize your tax return whether or not you need to wait for a K-1. Some folks don't understand what fiscal years are if they're do-it-yourselfers or they work with maybe someone who's not familiar with estates and how they work. They may think they have that September 1st beginning of the year to December 31st, 2016, they may think they have to file for a calendar year end. And that's not necessarily the case unless someone died in January. And then the longest fiscal year you could have would be December 31st. So you can have short years for the first year, and it can get complicated, but it really allows a lot of planning. And occasionally a trust can piggyback on that estate fiscal year. But generally, trusts have calendar year filings as well. But in the year of death, if someone had a living trust, if you've ever heard of a living trust, a revocable trust, if someone had one of those and it had certain provisions in it, the executor and trustee may elect to file
as one return, like the estate, and take on a fiscal year filing. So if you are involved with an estate or a trust, it may be worthwhile making sure that you understand how this can all work. And you want to work with people who understand how it works. All right. So that is S-Corps, Estates and Trusts. Then just bottom line, what's really interesting to me is each of these K-1s, they have different boxes. So the box for interest on the 1041 K-1 might be different than the box on the S-Corp, different on the box than the partnership. You'd think someone would coordinate and kind of make these boxes all the same and then make the different ones, you know, bigger numbers. So you want to make sure when you're putting the K-1 in your software, or your accountant is putting the K-1 in the software, that they make sure they're putting it in the right entity. So 1041 K-1 input should go in the 1041 K-1 input. 1065 for the partnership needs to go into the input for a 1065. You want to make sure you're putting it in the right section. I have heard about people putting it in the wrong places. So you want to make sure you're doing it in the right way. I want to take the last few minutes, unless we have any other calls, which again, the number is 610-758-8810, to talk for a minute about foreign tax credits and 529s and the use tax. So real quick on foreign tax credits. When people invest in mutual funds or certain companies, corporations that may have a presence here, something like Sanofi, you could receive a dividend that also incurs a foreign tax associated with it. When you get your 1099, you will have this information reported there. Now, if you don't have any foreign elements to your investments, then there won't be any foreign taxes. But typically, this is on brokerage statements. So you don't want to ignore that, because if you have income that you've reported that has an element of foreign income where a foreign country has taxed part of it, to the extent you have paid U.S. tax on that income, we get to take a foreign tax credit. Now, you can report those foreign tax credits on a form 1116, the 1116. There's also a way you can take it on Schedule A. Frankly, I always put it on the form 1116, so I haven't thought through putting it on Schedule A, because some people don't get to deduct, use the itemized deduction schedule, so I just always put it on the form 1116. And depending on how much income tax you paid on that same income, you could end up getting the full credit for those foreign taxes. And folks, I've seen this to the tune of, you know, hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars of foreign taxes, depending on how much foreign income there is. So that is something you don't want to ignore, because that is a dollar for dollar deduction against your income tax if it qualifies. Okay, so foreign tax credits. Now, that is different than if you have a foreign bank account, foreign signature authority, foreign assets. So I want to remind folks, if you have any foreign accounts, there is special reporting you have to do depending on how much is in, if you have more than $10,000 in a bank account in a foreign country, or if you have assets over a certain amount, depending on if you're married, filing joint, or single, you have to visit that every year, how much your assets were during, at any time during the year and at the end of the year. If they're over certain thresholds, you may have additional foreign reporting that has to be done on Form 114. And then there's another one related to that. Don't know it off the top of my head. Keep in mind, we're seeing more and more of that as we have people who have, come to work in this country and then have stayed, but continue to have foreign assets in maybe their homeland where they came from. All right. 529 contributions. 529 is the Internal Revenue Code section that governs college savings accounts. That's code section 529. If you put money into a college savings account, a 529, as an incentive to have people save up for education, the benefit that you will receive is tax-free earnings and growth on those accounts, as long as those accounts are used for qualified education expenses. So for federal purposes, you're not going to pay any income tax on all that earnings as long as you're using it for qualified education expenses. But several years ago under Governor Rendell, he gave us a deduction. When we make a contribution to a 529 account, we get a deduction on our Pennsylvania return. Think about it. It's a 3.07% instant savings on what we contribute to a 529. It's capped at $14,000 per person, per child. So I could give $14,000. My husband could give $14,000 to one child, two child, three child, children. But you have to have earned, you know, income. So if I don't work at all and we have no investment income and my husband works, then he could get the deduction. I would not benefit from the deduction because I don't have any income. But to the extent I have income, whether it's interest, dividends, wages, earned income, Schedule C, then I could get a deduction. And it's a 3.07% savings. So if I put $10,000 into an account, I save $307. Boom, just like that. 529s. You just have to remember to use it for qualified education expenses. I also like to remind people that if you your children are in their first 4 years of college education, undergrad, and you're below certain income thresholds, you may qualify for something called the American Opportunity Credit. You can't double dip your education benefits, so you have to coordinate your education benefits. You can't take money tax-free out of that 529 account, pay all the tuition, and get the American Opportunity Credit. You want to make sure that you're paying like $4,000 out of pocket, as long as you're going to qualify for it, so that you qualify for a $2,500 refundable credit. $2,500 for $4,000 out of pocket. It's free money. The use tax, folks, is just another word for sales tax. And Pennsylvania says, hey, if you go buy something out of state and you don't pay income tax, you're going to pay the income tax as if you bought it here, and you are required to report that, and you can pay for it on your PA-40. On page 2, there's a line called use tax. Now, if you say, hey, Lori, I went to another state, and their sales tax was 4%. I paid 4% over there. Well, then Pennsylvania wants you to pay the difference. So 6% minus 4%, 2% is what would be your use tax then for those purposes. So that's something that I think people don't pay much attention to. If I have clients who pay attention to it so much, they're diligent in giving me that number, $5.63 use tax. Boom, we put $5.63 on their that line item on page 2 of their Pennsylvania return, and we're covered. There is a table if you don't want to go through the steps of keeping track of all of it. There is a table that you can use, a default table based on your income, and just kind of use that number. If you know you never buy anything online, you don't ever buy anything out of the state, then it won't matter. So then you don't have to report it. Where they really pay particular attention is on business owners. So if you're a business owner, you have, I think, your own special separate use tax filing. And if they don't get one from you, they may send you a notice saying, hey, did you file your use tax return? If you didn't have any items that you purchased out of state at a less than 6% sales tax, you can fill it out and say, you know, not applicable. All right. So that wraps it up tonight, folks. Again, if you have questions, you can shoot them to me through yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can also listen over the next few weeks. We will be here during tax time. Next week, I am going to have a finance major from Temple University, Justin Cohen, on. He's been visiting the show for several weeks now, listening and interested in learning more about financial issues. And we're going to do a show on how much do college students understand about financial issues. He's been interviewing college students, and we're going to share the findings and talk about things that maybe we need to pay attention to as students or as parents for our students and what they need to pay attention to.
All right, so that'll be Justin Cohen next week, finance major at Temple University, and we'll have a good conversation and study his survey. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller within the tradition folk music. I want to thank Jeff for being here, Lori for being here, and listeners, thanks for calling in so much. I really appreciate it. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive, and make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week.